Welcome to the Samuel Andreev Podcast. To support this podcast, please visit the donation page of Samuel's website or his Patreon page. There are links in the description. Samuel's Twitter is at Samuel Andreev.
Welcome to the Samuel Andreev Podcast. I'm delighted to have as my guest today Anthony Etherin, who is a poet, publisher, musician, a jack of all trades. Anthony, it's really great to talk to you.
And it's good to be here. It's good to be invited. Thank you.
How would you define yourself if you were to embark upon such a hazardous enterprise?
I'd have to say a poet, I think. And I don't know if that's just because it's what I'm best known for now. Although I'd like to think that my press is doing quite well.
One of the things I want to talk to you about, actually, is the fact that you're mainly a poet, and you've got this press, Pentarac Press. But you're also involved in music. And since this is primarily a sort of music podcast, and most of the guests that I've had so far have been either composers or performers, I thought it'd be really interesting to talk to you because on the one hand, your sort of primary professional activity is not as a musician, but you are very involved in music and you have a sort of interesting perspective because you are very well known now as a poet, particularly on Twitter and online. But you have this engagement with music in a way that I think is extremely unique. So I wanted to talk about that because from what I understand, you've always sort of pursued these two things side by side. Is that more or less right? Or have there been periods where one has been more dominant than the other?
Well, when I was younger, it was all about music. And then poetry kind of found a way to sneak in. I was in bands as a teenager. And I was always the principal songwriter of the bands I was in. And eventually those bands fell apart and I got to the point where I didn't want to start another band because I didn't want to have to rely on other people, I think is one way to look at it. And then I realized that I could be a poet then because, you know, win or lose, it's all on me. I'm not requiring other people to do the work for me. So I learned how to write poetry properly only in my early 20s, I think. I didn't really know how to write poetry until then. I was writing this bad free verse that was essentially like song lyrics without the music to guide them. And so when I learned the rules of classical prosody and I learned about meter, I thought, well, there you are. There's the music. That's the musical accompaniment. It's there in rules. So I can use those rules to write something. Well, to write something poetic that doesn't just feel lost with this notion of complete freedom. I think gradually throughout my 20s, I moved away from music and towards poetry. But never letting music go because you can't really, can you?
Yeah, it's pretty sticky in a way, isn't it? I mean, once you get involved in music, it's very hard to extract yourself from it. Where are you today with that? You know, how does the music fit into your practice?
It doesn't fit in enough, really. It's between my poetry and running the press, I really don't get enough time to work on music. And it's very frustrating. I get a few hours a month and I feel like I should be having a few days or a few weeks a month because it was, music was everything for me growing up. I mean, you say that it sticks with you and it certainly does. I couldn't, I was trying to think of my earliest memories the other day because I know people who say that the earliest memories are things like the moon landing and the fall of the Berlin Wall. My earliest memory is waiting patiently for my mother to put a cassette tape on so I could listen to Flash Gordon by Queen, which is not a grand first memory, but it's mine, you know? So that shows the obsession. That's my earliest memories of music. I remember doing nothing from basically the first 15 years of my life, but all I wanted to do was listen to music.
It just strikes me as funny because maybe you've heard this, but there's a pretty hilarious quote from Leonard Cohen who actually started as a novelist and a poet and ended up becoming a successful songwriter. And he had some successes as a writer, but not enough. And he was not able to make a living as an author. And he was quite poor at one point and decided that he would resolve his financial distress by becoming a folk singer, which which he commented was probably the stupidest thing you could possibly do. I always thought that was very funny, but as it turns out, he ended up being hugely successful at that. But it's kind of funny in your case to have gone from music to poetry, which in many respects, like poetry is the thing that is, you know, of all the arts, perhaps, except for maybe ballet, is one of the hardest things to turn into a viable living. And somehow you've managed to put together a significant following and start a press and be extremely active and very well known in this field. But starting from, you know, this initial obsession with music. So that's an interesting and unique trajectory, you might say.
Yeah, but I didn't move from music to poetry because I was a success as a musician. If you give me the choice now of having been a rock star for the last 20 years, I might take that. So poetry was in that sense a second choice. Although, like I say, it suits me better, really, if I can work on my own and I'm not dependent on other people. And you know me, I'm quite a reclusive person, so I wouldn't necessarily be that interested in going on tour, traveling the world, which you have to do, I suppose, if you're a rock star.
Or any kind of musician. I mean, that's the trouble with music, is you can't really do it on your own. And you're dependent on having a strong network of collaborators and other enablers to get it out to people. And I think one of the things that, I mean, I've always found incredibly appealing about poetry is you need so little to do it, and it's very easy to get it out. Was that something that appealed to you, just the relatively low barrier, I suppose you might say, to being able to do it and to get it out there?
Yeah, definitely. On those two levels, the level of being able to disseminate the work quite easily, but also just, you know, when you write a poem, you're writing it and it's there in front of you and it's done. When you write music, you then have to record it, and then you have to work on the levels and all the production, all the things that go into that. And it seems very messy. So there's something very, very clean about just writing words on the page.
Yeah, there's an immediacy to that, for sure. And, you know, if you use a word processor, if you're clever with design, you can make it look nice also quite quickly. With music, you know, if you're writing a piece on paper with a pencil, then it's like you're sitting there at your desk sort of like hearing it in your head as best as you can. But it could be a year or 2 years before you actually hear a performance. And then it could be years more after that until there's a recording available. So it's a very, very slow process. And you have to, you know, you have to trust your senses, I suppose, for much of that time until it's actually a thing that physically exists in the world. So that is something that's incredibly appealing, I think, about poetry.
Yeah, I mean, I might feel differently if I had your talent and I was able to sit there in front of a blank stave and write something and hear it as I was writing it. I mean, that's something that always amazes me about composers. You know, I was a songwriter, not a composer. I had to have a guitar in my hands to write something.
Yeah, so tell me about that. Like, I understand that you were involved in this sort of punk ethos, especially when you were younger. And I'm really interested in that because there's something about punk that is incredibly appealing. Like this idea that you can just grab whatever you happen to have available and do something and do it yourself, right? Without necessarily relying on anybody else. Was that your experience? Can you talk a little bit about what that was like?
Well, I guess that's a theme. I don't want to rely on anybody. I want to do things myself and not have, not be dependent on anyone. What I thought you were going to say is, what, when people find out I was a punk rocker, they're surprised, because that's in a way the simplest kind of music. And I've gone from doing that to doing the most complicated kind of poetry. But I think it's related. It's simplicity and a desire for simplicity and the desire for complexity are actually very strongly connected, I think.
Well, I think in your case, the complexity of your writing does paradoxically manifest a kind of search for simplicity, because if you have a constraint, yeah, exactly. If you have a constraint or a rule and you have to follow it to the letter, and you're trying to make something flawless, you know, something really perfect, that is a form of simplicity. Right? So things that are symmetrical, things that are orderly, are simpler than things that are chaotic.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think what led me to punk wasn't what leads a lot of people to it. I think a lot of people do it because they think it's easy. or they do it because they think it's purely emotional. And I wasn't really that kind of artist, and I'm still not. I'm more interested in forms than feelings. So it definitely would have been the appeal of something that's very, without anything extraneous. It's just a very perfect form.
Yeah, but there are still, presumably, I mean, I'm not a big connoisseur of punk, but presumably there are still criteria according to which a punk song or album can be more or less effective. So what do you think those would be?
Oh, that's a very good question. I mean, there's dynamically, there's some unwritten rules there. It's got to be a bit shouty, for want of a better word. It's got to have some serious dynamism to it.
Is there such a thing as a punk ballad?
I don't know. I don't know how that could work. I know punk songs that call themselves ballads, but I don't really think they are. I don't know. How would you describe a punk ballad if you could?
That's a good question. Because one of the things I associate with punk is a kind of refusal of sentiment. And ballads, at least in popular music, tend to be very much on the sentimental side. So I don't know how you could really write a ballad without being sentimental. But I'm sure there's some expert out there who can contradict me and say, well, actually, there's all these different subgenres of punk. And, you know, there's probably some like hyper-emotional tearjerker style of punk music that I don't know about. Who knows?
Well, punk led to emo, didn't it, in a way? So I can imagine the emo ballad. But it's not punk.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not really the same thing. So when you were sort of a punk rocker, what did that involve? Like, and first of all, how did you get started with it? And what sort of, like, did you have a band? Were you doing everything yourself? How did that work?
Yeah, I formed a band. The things I started as a bass player, which is actually quite unusual, I think, that I wanted to be a bass player. Because most of the bass players I knew when I was younger were people who started with guitar. And they switched to bass either because they thought it would be easier, you know, two fewer strings, or they realized they had a better chance of getting into a band because there were so many guitarists and drummers and not many bass players. But I always wanted to be a bass player, which I think, you know, probably interesting reasons for that. I'm not entirely sure what they are, but I was really obsessed with being a bass player at a very young age. And then, of course, when you become a bass player and you learn to play bass, it's very difficult to be a solo artist. So I kind of had to find a band. And so about the age of 14, I formed my first band. And it carried on through school and until the end of university. And then that's when I'd had enough.
It would be like being a solo drummer.
Yeah.
There aren't too many of those either.
Yeah, I should have thought about that. Maybe I should have been. But I did eventually learn how to play guitar and sort of learn how to sing. But you've heard my singing, you know, that's only sort of.
So were you writing lyrics at that point?
Yeah, and lyrics were not important to me at all.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Why not?
I just loved music. I wanted to write the music, and then I knew that songs had to have lyrics. So all the lyrics for the first, perhaps the first 100 songs I wrote, all the lyrics were just written in about 2 minutes. Just whatever words fit, that would do.
So from these really early songs, are there any particular lyrics that you remember or are fond of at this point? Like, are there any that stick out that you can still sort of quote?
No. but if the answer is yes, I'm going to say no anyway.
Okay.
No, I had this sort of, because of the punk thing, I was trying to fulfill what I thought a punk band should be doing. So a lot of lyrics are these politically inflected rants that actually don't make any sense when you analyze them.
It's kind of a paradox with punk, right? Because one of the things about it is this sort of renegade quality, this sort of hyper-individuality and sort of being at odds with the rest of society. But at the same time, as you say, there's a level of conformism, right? Because there are expectations as to what you're going to get if you hear a punk song.
Well, exactly, yeah. And you go to a punk gig, or when I did in the 90s, and you see all these Mohicans and you think, well, is that individuality? A whole sea of Mohicans.
Did you have the look and everything?
I did, yeah. I mean, the other people in my band didn't, and most people I knew didn't, but for some reason I wanted that. So, I was all safety pins and dyed hair.
Seems high maintenance.
It was. I can't believe I did it. I'm certainly not like that these days.
Yeah, well, there's the straight edge punks though that you can, you know, you can do that if you don't want to go to all the trouble of maintaining the look.
Aren't they teetotal though?
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Not, no.
Not for you. It's really interesting. I mean, to start out as a punk bass player and then end up as this author of extraordinarily refined poetry, using very sophisticated and complex techniques. And the other thing is, like, having known you for a while now, I don't think I could possibly have guessed you would have done that in the past.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the fact I was a punk is strange when you look at what I'm doing now. I think the fact I was a musician isn't strange. And I've noticed, you know, among my fan base, fans of my poetry, there's an unusually high number of musicians in there. It's musicians and historians, I've noticed. They're interested in what I do. I think that's probably because of the formalist stuff. But yeah, like I said, I got into writing poetry once I learned about the rules of prosody and traditional formal verse. So all of this was an attempt to get over the fact I couldn't write free verse without some sort of guiding rhythm. So I like to think I'm a musical poet. I also think with the constraints that I use, I'm a pattern seeker. And I would say, I mean, this might be a bit sweeping, but I would probably say musicians are the ultimate pattern seeking artists. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think fundamentally, music is an art of patterns. There are many different types of patterns, of course, and they can be low-level patterns. In other words, things that you can immediately identify and that manifest themselves in very obvious ways, or they can be high-order patterns, which are things that might escape your perception, or they might have an oblique effect on your perception. But it's very difficult to think of music of any kind that on some level or another doesn't have pattern-making as a sort of a primary quality. And I think that music that has the power to fascinate people and to move them very deeply in many cases has unbelievably intricate patterns and layers of patterns, like multiple hierarchies of patterns within the piece. And a lot of these do not operate consciously. And that's something I've become increasingly aware of, I would say, in the past few years.
Yeah, well, this is absolutely right. I mean, and this applies to the poetry I like as well. You're not going to notice necessarily if I've written a 100 line palindrome, you're not going to see the patterns until you've read the whole thing. And in fact, maybe not even then, but they are there.
Well, just as a thought experiment, if you were to put your stuff out on Twitter and publish it in books without explaining to anybody how it was made, how do you think that would affect or condition the response? Because you do tend to say, well, this is a palindrome, this is a sestina, this is a lipogram, and so on.
Well, if you bear with me a second, this might be something you have to edit out. Let's pause while I look something up. I had a comment on one of my poems a couple of days ago, so hopefully it won't take me long to find it. And I'd written a palindrome, which perhaps I could read out. It's only short. So this is just the kind of short palindromes I'd like to post on Twitter. I like to write what the poem is, what form it is in the title. So this is called Drab, and I've written Drab, and then in parentheses, palindrome. And it goes like this. Drab, a lie vined, a lost elm, a halo of a sun. I am at a minus, a fool, a hamlet so laden I veil a bard. So that's a short palindromic poem. And somebody replied to it saying, that's really cool. What are the rules for this form? Are they rhythmic or is it about the number of lines? So that's really nice because I got to reply saying, well, it's actually this. But it's really nice as well because that person just liked the poem without having to like it because of its structural properties.
Yeah, I always wonder about this because there are branches of art and literature in which the generative process, let's say, or the discourse around the art itself are part of it. Here's an interesting example. I don't know if you know the music of Erik Satie.
Yeah.
He would put these indications in his scores that are really quite funny in French, right? And he would put these sort of instructions to the performer that would be like, play as though you can't find your glasses or something like this, or play as though as though you're inside a hole. Like there's a whole series of these completely absurd indications. And the thing is, like, they're in the score. So you'll only be aware of those if you're actually playing the piece or if you're reading the score. But the average person listening to the piece is going to have no idea that there's all these indications. So it's like a kind of a paramusical dimension to the piece. But it adds something to it. It adds to the allure of the work. And I think that's true in a lot of conceptual writing and constraint-based writing as well. Yes, you can appreciate the work on its own autonomous terms, but it also adds something to it when you have a sense of how it was actually put together.
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's quite interesting with certain things. Like, for example, that poem I just read, it's just a palindrome. So it's nice if someone comments as that person did, not knowing it. But then there are other poems I've written that are more complicated, and I want people to know what I've done. Because it's, in some ways, it's almost impossible for anyone to just read that and intuitively like it, unless you know that the structure of the poem is a part of the poem, that the concept behind the poem is as much an artistic statement as the words in that poem.
But the thing with palindromes, though, is that they force you to write things that you would never have written otherwise. Right, like, and the prose and sometimes the syntax will have a quality that is somewhat alien, but you can't quite exactly figure out why. So even if you didn't, even if someone showed you a palindrome and didn't tell you what it was or how it was made, you would still notice that there was something peculiar about it.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And people either like that or they won't. A lot of people don't like things that go beyond or vary from a typical syntax, which I guess there is a direct analogy there with music that isn't modal. A lot of people get very angry about that. I'm sure you've experienced them.
Yeah, it's funny. People have expectations about what they're going to get.
Yeah,
but it's almost as though you were in a supermarket and you were expecting that you'd be able to buy a quart of milk or something, and you get it home and it's something completely else. You get angry. People have an idea that art is a commodity, I think, and that they're going to get exactly what they expect or what they've paid for. And I guess people who think that way, consciously or unconsciously, are going to have a hard time dealing with what you do or what I do. But, you know, it's not for everybody.
It's completely fine if they think that way, so long as they don't then decide to have a go at me about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Try and expect something from me that I'm clearly not willing to give them.
Yeah, it's funny that it still upsets people, though. It's like there must be, you know, 2.5 million poets in the world that they can choose from. But it's like, this guy over here isn't doing what I'm after. That's no good. Got to stop that.
Yeah, I've had people not just offend me, but tell me that the entire tradition I'm working within is wrong. I mean, that takes some confidence to say that to somebody, I think.
But your work has become primarily known through Twitter, which is an interesting thing in and of itself. And I suspect that that also ties back to the whole punk thing, right? Because there's something very do-it-yourself about Twitter, very automatic. It's very direct. What was the appeal of Twitter when you started putting out your writing that way?
Well, it's quite interesting to think that there's a connection between the punk thing and Twitter. And maybe there is. I really started on Twitter out of complete necessity. That I live in the middle of the countryside in Shropshire, where there aren't a lot of resources for poets.
Wait, that's in New Zealand, right?
Middle Earth,
right?
So yeah, I don't live in a big city. I don't have those kind of connections. I'm not associated with the university, which is a big thing still in poetry. I didn't have any connections to established poets or publishers. And when you're in that position, there's not a lot you can do to break into the poetry world. So I joined Twitter, but it took my wife, Clara, it took her 2 years to convince me to open a Twitter account. I was quite resistant.
Oh, why is that?
I think for probably good reasons. The reasons I still don't quite like it, because when you see the level of hostility there, it doesn't look like a nice place. But it is a nice place if you find the right corners of it. but I didn't appreciate that at the time. But I joined and I started tweeting poems that nobody saw. And after about 3 months, a poet named Pedro Portevin discovered me, and he started retweeting me. And then another poet called Christian Book, who you know, saw these tweets, and he started retweeting me. And then it snowballed from there.
Yeah, it's an interesting platform, right? Because all it really takes in a certain sense is to get the attention of one or two people with significant followings. Things can change very quickly.
Yeah, and it was remarkable after, you know, this. I was 34 years old at this point, after years and years of writing music and poetry and not really having any audience. About a year later, I suddenly had quite a significant audience.
Was the lack of an audience something that weighed upon you? Was it was it something that you regretted?
Yeah, I think so. I'd like to say no. But you do wonder after a point, you do wonder what you've done with your life when suddenly, you suddenly realize that you're 34 years old and you've dedicated your life to the arts and yet nobody really cares about your art. That's quite a difficult thing to deal with.
Yeah, although it's a very common situation to be in a certain sense. And I think it takes a great deal of fortitude to get through those times and to keep pressing forward. Because the ones that do, the ones that survive and keep producing new work and putting it out, you know, it's a truism, but you're much likelier to get there if you keep doing it and you're persistent than if you stop because you're disgusted with your, you know, lack of appreciation.
Yeah, but I always enjoyed it. So that's why I carried on. There was never a point where I stopped enjoying either poetry or music. I mean, certainly I've gone through long periods of not writing music because I just lost interest in the form. And similarly with poetry, there'd be times when I didn't want to write anything, but at least having the two arts there, I've always been interested in at least one of them at the same time, at the time. So that helped, that no matter how upset I was that I didn't have an audience, I was still going to carry on because I just wanted to do it. I was compelled to do it.
Yeah, but so you've experienced both. You've experienced total obscurity and you've experienced having a large following. How has that changed things for you? Like, what are the aspects of the following, let's say, that have been positive?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's a large following for the kind of thing I do. It's... which generally doesn't have a large following. So it's not like I'm suddenly famous. I think it's quite impossible to be famous doing what I do. Although Christian Book had a good go with it.
Yeah, but that's true everywhere in the arts. It's like the fame is always contextual. It's like nobody's famous in all contexts everywhere in the world, you know, unless you're the president of a major country or something like that.
Yeah, oh, of course, yeah.
Well, I'm just interested in what, you know, how that's changed your experience of being an artist. Like, does it change your relationship to the work itself, knowing that?
Oh, it does. The idea that people are watching.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Because I remember when I started on Twitter, I'd post any old rubbish because it didn't matter. I put some terrible poems up there just because, you know, why not? Whereas now I know that there are lots of people who are going to read this. So I think it's got to be quite good.
So it makes you more self-conscious.
It does, yeah. And I think I mean, that's the positive side to it, though, in a way. It's made me refine my work a bit. I don't know if there's a negative there in that perhaps it's taken away some creative freedom. I don't think so, but I mean, that seems like a possibility.
I mean, in my case, it's probably made me somewhat more averse to doing things that are sort of casual one-offs, you might say, like things that are really improvised in nature, or that, you know, in which there isn't necessarily a great deal of thought that goes into it. Whereas 20 years ago or 15, 10 years ago, maybe I wouldn't have minded doing something like that. But now if someone asks me to do a short sort of occasional piece or write a miniature or something like that, I really think twice. And most of the time I say no, because I think, well, do I really want to create something and put it out? And am I going to have the time to do this properly and do it the way I would like? And is it going to have enough depth to it? Or is it just going to be some trivial thing that is just going to be sort of some extra noise in my work list?
because of my experiences before, I think whenever I'm asked to do something, if a magazine approaches me saying, can we have one of your poems, or would you like to write a poem for us, I tend to take those opportunities just with this, I think it's a different argument really, but just from the idea that you don't know what's going to happen if you don't take that chance.
That's true too. Yeah, I don't know. I always have a trouble finding the right balance between doing enough to be productive, I suppose, and make consistent progress on the one hand. Because it's true, you do have to create a lot of work, I think, in order to get to the peaks, let's say, the things that are really the key works. But at the same time, I think if you put out a lot of stuff into the public sphere, so to speak, you want to think very carefully about what you're focusing people's attention on. It's like, do you really want people to spend time with this particular piece, or would you rather have a smaller number of works but make it so that there's a more intense degree of focus on them? I think with poetry it's different though, especially with very short things and things that you can put out in a tweet.
Well, the thing about tweets in general is that they appear, then they disappear.
Yeah, they're ephemeral, except that you know, in your case, you archive them, of course, and they end up in books.
Well, the good ones do. There are plenty of bad poems that have gone through my Twitter feed and just disappeared. But then a lot of the tweets are drafts. I'll post the same poem three or four times, and it's slightly different each time, and I'm just refining it.
Do you think of Twitter as being a form of publication?
Well, I don't know. There are lots of ways to view this, because lots of publishers will view it as a publication and therefore not accept it because it's already been published if it's been on Twitter. But I also know people who call Twitter their notepad. Which I quite like. I mean, it does, as a publisher, it doesn't bother me if somebody's put their poems on Twitter before. I think it's weird to worry about things like that.
Yeah, it's probably a new category, actually. I mean, if you really wanted to think about it in those terms, it's not exactly the same thing as publishing, but it has many of its characteristics. But yeah, in a certain sense, who cares? You know, you just put your work out there, and if it's a draft, it's a draft, and if it's a finished piece, it's a finished piece. But nevertheless, you still do books. So why do the books?
Well, a number of reasons. Only one of which is money, which that's not, and don't worry, I don't get much money. Well, I love books. I mean, you've got to love books, haven't you? I think as nice as Twitter is, I want a book. I want something you can hold. You know, a nice hardback, a good weight paper, all these things that since entering into publishing, I'm now obsessed with all different paper types and paper weights.
Yeah, I don't know about you, but I really want to get your perspective on this, actually. But ever since early March with the lockdown, I've developed this kind of visceral disgust with virtual media of almost all kinds, particularly YouTube, but anything internet-based. And I don't know what it is, and a renewed desire to engage with physical things.
That's interesting. Even YouTube, you know, after all it's done for you.
Well, YouTube's done a lot for me, but I have to admit, I see it as a kind of a necessary evil. It wouldn't be my first choice to make YouTube videos. I do it because it's a platform that allows me to, you know, get things out to a large number of people. And there are many advantages, and it's also, you know, in many respects, it's enabled me to make a living, which is kind of amazing. But in terms of the physical experience of sitting in a chair, opening a browser, opening YouTube, watching a video all the way through, it's just, I should probably not be saying this, but it's not something I particularly like to do with my time, unless there's something that I can't get any other way, which is often the case, actually. Yeah, I'd rather be outside. I'd rather be outside. I'd rather be reading a book or swimming or going on a bike ride or being with my family or something.
You know, a few times over the last couple of years, I've bought an ebook, got about 20 pages into it, and then just bought a paperback of the same book because I don't want to sit there looking at a screen reading a book. If you're reading a book, you should be reading paper.
Yeah, well, people often send me PDFs of things, and if it's an article or a score or something that I really want to read, I'll actually print it out. I can't imagine sitting in front of the computer and reading a 20-page article. I'll always print it out. Maybe that's idiotic, but you know, a lot of people, when the internet started to become really, really big, predicted that books would disappear, physical media of all kinds would disappear, and that we would all just have these tiny little devices and everything would be stored on those. But that actually hasn't happened. What has in fact happened is you have various different kinds of media that exist parallel to each other and that serve different purposes. And there have been a lot of surprises, like the LP had a significant resurgence.
Hmm. Yeah, and good. That's a good thing.
Yeah, and I think that there is something sort of unsatisfying and just tiring about spending a lot of time on the internet, but I'm sure it's different for different people. How's that been for you?
What's better, spending more and more time on the internet? Or
out of necessity, because presumably interacting with your followers and the business of running a press, a lot of that would require you to spend a lot of time on the internet, I imagine.
Yeah. Well, that's not so bad because it's what I've been doing anyway. I don't write a lot by hand. So I'm generally, when I'm writing poetry, I'm writing it in, you know, in Microsoft Word. So I'm quite used to staring at the screen. Could be why my eyesight has rapidly declined over the last few years. But yeah, I'm used to it. I don't really like it. I do have to remind myself as well to get away and go for a walk, just to rest my eyes.
Yeah, I think the thing that I find disturbing about it is the incredible adhesive quality of a lot of this media. It's like you can't quite get rid of it. It's like a burr or something that sticks to your shoe, and then you pull it off, and then it immediately sticks itself to your pant leg or something.
You got rid of your smartphone for a while, didn't you?
I've done it a few times, which I suppose shows you something about my internal fortitude.
See, I didn't have one at all until I started Twitter 4 years ago, in fact. I didn't have one at all until then.
I actually resisted quite a long time before getting a mobile phone of any kind. And I didn't actually get a smartphone until relatively late. And yeah, I have a love-hate relationship with it. On the one hand, I find it to be a disgusting incursion on my freedom, and like in a weird way, because it's a totally voluntary restriction of my freedom. That's how it appears to me. Like the fact that someone can send me a message at any time of day, or any time at night, and I'll immediately get a notification and I'll see it right away. And then it's like, there's something addictive about it. Like you can't, it's like, of course you can turn the notifications off and you can put your phone on airplane mode or whatever, but you get used to having that endorphin rush that comes with getting the buzz on your phone and getting immediate feedback on something you've done. It's very, very hard to turn that off. I've gotten a little bit better at it, but there have been times where I get so disgusted with it that I just take the phone and put it in a shoebox and then use a flip phone for a few months, which is, you know, not a very compelling object. So it's like you don't really use it very much.
That's interesting that you go to those lengths.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the problem is I'm an optimistic person, so I keep thinking, well, I mean, this is totally voluntary. All I have to do is decide not to look at the phone, or I just have to decide, to restrict my use or whatever. But it just keeps creeping back, you know? And so if I really start to get uncomfortable with it, with the fact that I'm, you know, scrolling through Twitter or something instead of reading a book or whatever, or doing the dishes, something else that I should be doing, I gradually start to notice that I'm wasting time in that way. And I think, well, okay, the only way I can really deal with this, because it's become such an unconscious habit, is to just put it away and use a flip phone. And that works. It sort of breaks the spell very quickly. And the first couple of days are a bit weird. And then quickly you start to, in my case, I started to notice that I was actually focusing better. But I'd love to have the advantages of the phone, you know, without the feeling of something like a leech-like appendage, you know?
Well, I think that's the thing, isn't it? You've got to decide that you're the one who's in charge. The phone does not rule you.
It does. That's the thing. It actually does. And it's really pernicious. And I think we don't really quite realize it. But I'm pretty sure the phone is actually the boss and not us.
Perhaps. And my Twitter account too, because you know, I work the computer all day. I always have my Twitter account open on the tab, and I'm frequently flicking on to see what's happening, see what notifications are there.
So you've had a few tweets that have gone viral, that have been massively popular. So what happens in that case? Are you just sort of you know, you're like waiting to see what happens next. It must be very exciting.
Well, the biggest one was the Idris Elba palindrome about James Bond, when it was in the news that Idris Elba might be the next James Bond. I don't know if he still might be. I don't keep up with it. I don't really like James Bond that much. So, but I wrote a palindrome about it. And I remember that day I was very, I didn't know it was a Friday night. I tweeted it and not a lot happened with it. So when I went to bed, I think it was doing okay. Had about 40 likes. And I woke up in the morning and it had about 200 likes. And I thought that was quite interesting. I got really drunk that Friday night. You won't be surprised to hear. And so I was really hungover. And I was just looking at my phone and thinking, well, it's got 200 likes. That's pretty much the most I've ever had. And then eventually by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, because I kept checking it, about by 3 o'clock in the afternoon that day, that Saturday, it had 500 likes. And I thought that was amazing. And then I was looking at my phone when a notification came through saying, J.K. Rowling has retweeted you. And that's when things went crazy. And I had 15 minutes of just madness, and my phone kept crashing because all the notifications kept spilling through. Because this very famous writer had retweeted me. And yeah, so after, by Sunday, it had 7,000 likes for this weird little palindrome about James Bond. So that was strange.
What were the after effects of that?
I think it generated about 3 sales of my book. Because people don't care. You know, people look at what you've done and they click like because they like it. They don't then check out who you are and take an interest in your career. Or most of them don't.
Yeah, but nevertheless, like your books do actually sell relatively well by at least by poetry standards, which is worth noticing, right? Because it's incredibly hard to sell poetry.
It is, yeah.
Like what do you think would be harder to sell than poetry? Manure? Like I'm trying to imagine.
That's quite easy to sell manure. It's
that's true.
No, there were some weird discrepancies in what we were willing to pay for. That you'll pay as much for a coffee as for a book of poetry, and you think that coffee's worth it, but you're not sure about the poetry.
Yeah, right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, coffee's expensive now.
It's more, yeah, it's too expensive. Poetry isn't too expensive.
That's
buy
right.
Poetry, people. Buy poetry. And music, well, music's interesting, isn't it? What's happened in the music industry, where, to be honest, it was making too much money back in the 90s.
Yeah, people will pay for bottled water, which is like the most unbelievable thing you can think of. But spending, you know, $2 on a paid download is just beyond the pale for most people.
How much has the music industry been affected by downloads?
Well, it's been utterly transformed from top to bottom in every respect. Yeah, it's a completely different industry now. It's basically led to the death of the album format, I would say. I mean, people still do albums, but it's not really an art form the way it was at one point. You know, the album thing was always tied to the physical format of the LP and its particular restrictions. So already with CDs, where you can have up to 80 minutes, it sort of started to change the format a little bit. But with downloads, it's like there's no reason why something has to be 40 minutes long or 70 minutes long. You can do it a 6-hour long album, or you can release a 30-second clip. It makes no difference. You know, so that certainly changed things, and it's changed people's listening habits. I grew up in the 1990s, 1980s and 1990s, and I loved LPs. Like by that point, LPs were already out. And CDs were the big thing, but I still preferred LPs and I used to go and buy them.
Well, CDs are the one thing that haven't made a comeback, because even cassettes have made a bit of a comeback, but people don't really like CDs.
There's never been much affection for the CD format, really, which you can kind of understand. Mm. It's not, they're not cute. They're not beautiful. They're kind of annoying. They have those chintzy jewel cases that are always breaking. You know, the print is always too small, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas LPs can actually be quite beautiful, elegant objects. And they're a lot of fun. So, but I would sit and listen to them all the way through. And then there's the ritualistic aspect of having to put the needle down and turn it over and all that kind of thing, which meant you actually had to sit there.
Yeah, you're not completely passive in it.
Yeah, exactly. You're not completely passive. You can't just sort of come up with some 80-hour long playlist on Spotify and just click the mouse once and it'll just keep going for days on end. I'm of two minds about it again, because the convenience is pretty incredible. Like, you can find things now with basically no effort and no cost that would have been incredibly complicated to get copies of 20 years ago. But at the same time, I'm deeply nostalgic for the era in which it was, you know, there's a certain commitment involved in buying a recording, sitting down and listening to it, engaging with it on that level.
Yeah, I don't use playlists these days. If I want to listen to a song, I put that song on. And if I want to hear another song, I have to think about what song I want to hear next. Because I don't want that experience of just creating a playlist and then putting it on and listening to it passively.
Right. I suspect that it's changed the poetry world somewhat less than the music world, right? Because even though there's a lot of writers putting their stuff out on Twitter and other platforms, it strikes me as unlikely that the main readership would be people reading tweets. Right? That'll be a way to get people to know about your work, but at some point, people who are seriously interested in it are going to probably buy a book.
Yeah, I think there are lots of things going on there. For one, that there'll be people who are never going to buy poetry books anyway, but who might become interested in what's being tweeted. And maybe a small number of them will decide to buy a book on the basis of that. But even those who don't, at least they're engaging with poetry in some way.
Yeah, whereas that might never have happened otherwise. I mean, it's the whole Rupi Kaur thing, which you discussed with Christian.
The Insta poets are selling books now. People aren't just looking at their work on Instagram.
Well, they're not just selling books. They're selling huge numbers of books, right? I mean, these are actually becoming bestsellers.
Yeah. Yeah, but well, crazy bestsellers too, you know, really selling a lot more than anything you would call more traditional or mainstream, or what's, you know, this is the funny thing, that's not mainstream poetry, and yet it's selling a lot more than what we think of as mainstream poetry.
Yeah, but wouldn't it be an amazing achievement if you could make music that would be a commodity on that same level, in the sense that, like, it would be something you would buy, sort of like buying a mug or a postcard, and it would well, what am I saying? I mean, that does exist. Popular music is sort of like that. But I mean, within the framework, let's say, of composition as opposed to popular music, which is maybe sort of what's happening with the Insta poets, right? Where it's not primarily a popular art form, but they've sort of managed to commodify it in a way that that nobody could have anticipated, I think. And it's very surprising that that's happened on one level.
Yeah, but it's very difficult for most poets to look at this and get anything from it that's useful. Because it is a bit like, you know, someone said to me recently, it's encouraging, isn't it, that people like Rupi Kaur and these Instagram poets are selling a lot. Isn't that good news for you? And it's a bit like someone saying, you know, Katy Perry sells lots of records. Isn't that great for your death metal band?
Right.
It's a completely different thing. It's almost a different art form. It's certainly a different genre. And poetry has a problem with that, not realizing there are lots of different genres. You'll get poetry events where you get people reading one after the other, and there's no kind of logic behind the billing. It's like going to a concert and seeing a bit of classical music followed by Iron Maiden, followed by a jazz quartet.
Right.
So, yeah, poetry does have this weird thing where poetry is viewed as one genre. So I don't know what I could really get from the fact that somebody who writes poetry completely different from mine is selling lots of books.
Just as a hypothetical, like, suppose that your Twitter presence continues to increase. Like, imagine it sort of increased very dramatically, and you had, you know, the ability to have your tweets seen by millions of people, which actually I'm sure is already the case, but imagine that were even more consistently the case, and that started to be reflected in book sales and so on. What if it became a phenomenon? Would that be something you would desire in and of itself? And what would you see as being a kind of a desirable outcome of all of this?
Well, there is this idea in the arts that if you get really popular, you've done something wrong. I don't know if that's the punk in me speaking. But that you think question, that, you know, if what you do is universally appealing, then it's obviously not challenging enough people.
Do you think that's true?
I think it's true to some extent, don't you?
Not automatically. Because there's a lot of reasons why people become famous, and they might not all have to do with the work itself. There might be reasons that are quite peripheral, actually, to the work. But I don't see it as being a bad thing in and of itself, because suppose that you become significantly famous, and let's just say for the sake of argument that 1 in 1,000 people that knows about you actually engages, you know, significantly with the work itself, as opposed to just sort of being vaguely aware of the fact that you exist. That's still a good thing.
There's going to be a lot but that's the second part of your question. And yeah, I want that to happen, definitely. I'd rather that happen than didn't overall. I want to promote a certain type of poetry as well. You know, this is one of the reasons I run the press. I think that there's been a certain style of poetry that's been very dominant in almost a bullying way, in fact, for a very long time now, and other traditions.
In the UK, you mean specifically, or overall?
I think overall, but the UK is probably the main offender. So, I want to promote these other styles of poetry. So if I can get popular doing that, then that means I've succeeded in that goal.
So what are these sort of officially sanctioned styles of verse that are becoming oppressive in your view?
Well, it's a certain lyrical type. I mean, one way to define it, I guess, is the idea lots of people have about poetry, if they don't know about all the different types of poetry that are out there. Most people would say it's about expressing your emotions and your sensory experiences. But there's plenty of poetry that doesn't do that. There's plenty of poetry that starts with language and just experiments with language. And it's not taken as seriously as poetry that is supposed to be emotive in some way, and flagrantly emotive, and emotive in these very overtly sentimental ways that are supposed to stir us. Because it's been pointed out to me when I've said this before, someone said, well, if you enjoy a poem, enjoyment is an emotion. And that's true. But that's not what these types of poetry are getting at. It's the emotional reaction to a sensory stimulus.
My feeling has always been that the emotional response should be a byproduct rather than the intended effect.
Well, it shouldn't be demanded, which is what a lot of poetry does. It demands an emotional response, or it demands a political response.
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of thing that sets my teeth immediately on edge. It's sort of like having a stranger sort of come over and stick their tongue in your ear. You know, it's invasive and a bit gross. Although I'm sure there are people that vie for that sort of experience.
Well, strangers sticking their...
It takes all kinds.
Well, yeah. Who are we to judge?
Who are we to judge, yeah. Yeah, it seems to me that like the work that most stridently insists that they want their listenership or their readership to have some kind of intense emotional response to the work itself, it's exactly that kind of work that's likeliest to push me away.
Yeah, well, maybe that's what's happened. You know, there has to be some reason why poetry has declined in popularity so much over the last 100 years.
What's your metric for that? How can you know?
I say 100, but I'm thinking... immediately comes to mind is the idea of Lord Byron being a superstar. I mean, that's 200 years rather than 100, but he was selling more books then than a lot of the most popular poets now sell. And that's odd when you think about how the world was different, so different. And we still have many figures from the last 100 years, the first half of the 20th century, who are clearly more culturally significant than people who've been working in the last 30 or 40 years. I don't know if I should be saying this. we can half edit some of this, surely.
Right. No, let's have the numbers.
You put me on the spot. Well, I mean, how precise do you want the metric here? I don't have stats to show you.
No, but I mean, well, but you have the perception anyway, and I'm sure widespread.
People also share that perception. Yeah,
that it's not the cultural force that it would have been at one time.
Yeah, let's leave it there.
Yeah, I wonder if that has to do partly with the fact that, you know, reading poetry does require a certain amount of investment. I suppose until not actually all that long ago, it would have been a normal thing to read Latin and to be educated in multiple languages and to have a sort of a classical education. And along with that would have come a certain base understanding of poetry and prosody and things like that. And that just doesn't seem to be a common thing anymore. So, you know, people will not even know that poetry exists unless someone shoves it in front of them.
Yeah, so I mean, going back to the conversation that's going to get me into trouble. When I was at school, I can only speak about growing up in the UK and being educated in the 80s and 90s. But at school, I was only taught about the sort of lyrical, emotionally expressive poetry that is the prevailing form now. And it really does shock me that I wasn't taught about meter or four or traditional poetic forms at all while at school. I had to learn that on my own. Whereas for many, many years, for centuries, knowing how to write metered poetry was knowing how to write poetry. So something bizarre has gone on there. That you're required to appreciate poetry on the basis of pretty much nothing, on the basis of no real technical skills.
Yeah, when I was an adolescent, actually, and not very well educated in poetry, I guess most of the things that I was seeing and reading, which would have been mostly quite recent things, were totally unstructured and unmetered and had no rhyming scheme or anything like that. And that's a generalization, of course, but there's a lot of poetry that doesn't really preoccupy itself with those questions. And a lot of it is essentially prose, actually, especially the more lyrical or confessional varieties of poetry, where it's basically prose that's been chopped into lines, a lot of it.
Yeah, I think that's probably what I have more of a problem with than... I don't want to sound like a robot. I don't actually have a problem with people discussing their emotions. But yeah, it's the fact that there's a lack of technique, but I don't mean that in a stuffy way either. Just perhaps a lack of care over what you're doing and thought over every single word, which I think is a very important thing in poetry. The same way that thought over every single note is important in music.
Yeah, there's something to that. I mean, I was reading Louis Zukofsky the other day, who's a American modernist poet that I really like. He came after Ezra Pound. He's a little bit, I think maybe born 20 years later, something like that. And it was this poem with maybe, I don't know, no more than 40 words. But I had to read it about maybe 10 times, at least 10 times, to get any sense of its architecture, and not to mention the question of meaning. And not just sort of glance over it, but really actually read it quite closely and carefully. It took a significant effort to even start to scratch the surface of what was there. And then once you've done that, made that effort, you know, put that engagement in, you look at it again, and you can then read it in 30 seconds, but you start to appreciate what an exquisite structure it is and how beautifully it's put together. I love that. I love the ability that poetry has to put an enormous amount into a very small space.
Yeah. There's, if you don't mind me going on about this, I talk about this a lot. And I know what this is, the Sater Square.
Oh, yes, yeah. Satura repo tenet opera rotas.
There you are, you know it very well. So for your listeners, this is a word square, five-letter words arranged in a square so that the square can be read horizontally or vertically, and it says the same thing, but also the whole thing is a palindrome, so you can read it horizontally or vertically from the bottom right corner as well as the top left corner. And the translation of this is a farmer or a sower called Arepo works with the wheel. And this is a Latin, but this is about 2,000 years old. And so one of my arguments is, okay, let's just judge this on its lyrical content, shall we? A farmer named Arepo works with a wheel. Now that's shit. Really. That's a terrible poem. And that's how a lot of people judge poetry. They'll say, well, look, he just says this. But no, this has endured for 2,000 years and it's been loved for 2,000 years and it's going to be around for another 2,000 years at least. And that's why it's beautiful. The content of the words is secondary to the aesthetic qualities of the object. And this is something that I think is very missing from poetry right now. And it's something I'm trying to champion.
Well, it's sort of like Cézanne with all his paintings of apples. It's like, they're not about the apples. He didn't care about the damn apples, you know? And it's amazing that should be an obvious thing, but it's very easy to lose sight of that. The aesthetic in itself is extremely important.
Well, Apollinaire wrote essays about the cubists, saying this thing that intentionally the cubists are going to keep painting guitars, violins, nudes, fruit bowls, because they don't want you to be looking at what's going on in the image. They want you to be looking at how they're doing it, how they're portraying it. So, yeah, poetry seems to have forgotten this.
Well, music has as well, actually. Well, not popular music. Popular music still does that. But contemporary music, a contemporary composition, let's say, doesn't do that. It doesn't have a repertory of symbols or of what you might call sort of neutral tropes that can operate as a kind of a litmus test of what this is, what this artist can do. You put this neutral sort of stopgap thing in. It's like Picasso with all of his paintings of guitars and so on. And that's something I often regret. And I've often thought it would be desirable to try to reinstate a kind of vocabulary of these sorts of things into music somehow. Not exactly sure how to do that, but let's say archetypes.
Musical if you find archetypes. Out, tell me.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Well, you know that, because we've talked about this a lot lately, you know that I stopped writing songs because I got so bored of working within the same song format, verse, chorus, and so I've been trying to figure out how else a song can be written, and it will still be recognizable as a song, but it won't have this, you know, this tediously repetitive verse, chorus, because I'm more interested in the form of something than what's going on within it.
Yeah, it's tricky with songs, isn't it? Because if you stray too far from the template, it no longer functions as a song.
But classical music is a lot more varied. I mean, I'm not at all an expert on this.
Well, you have genres within classical music, and they had a functional nature to them.
So the genres are they formal, though? So you'd expect certain forms in certain genres?
I would say that they're contextual and utilitarian. So, for instance, if you're writing music to accompany a dinner service or something, which a lot of classical composers did, you know, they wrote music for balls or for specific social events, things like that, then there would be conventions. There would be things that you'd be expected to do as a matter of course. There would be certain types of dances that would be expected. If you were writing a piece for, let's say, a liturgy, then that would also have very specific expectations surrounding it. You can't just suddenly drop in something that's completely alien to that context. And if you're writing a piece of instrumental music to be played by the gifted amateur, or to be played, let's say, in a virtuoso sort of showpiece type of context, then there would be expectations with that too. I mean, there's really no particular corner of classical music where it's free of all expectations, right? Where there's no expectation attendant upon the composer writing in that genre. So I'm not actually sure that's true. But of course, the great composers, the ones that get remembered, are the ones that did things that were exceedingly personal, or that pushed the boundaries a lot farther than anybody else could have imagined within those particular genres. But even the most exceptional, renegade, experimental, forward-thinking composers, there's still something recognizably archetypal about the forms and the genres within which they're working. Like it's very rare that someone would create something and it would be a totally unrecognizable object, like something alien, right? Where it's like, well, this is totally impossible to interpret.
That's interesting. I mean, what do you think is more important? And this can, your answer can be about poetry as much as music. What do you think is more important, originality or mastery?
I think it's the same thing. I don't think there is a distinction to be made there. I think if you, you know, mastery is two things. I think it's there's mastery of the self and there's mastery of materials. And if you master those two things, it will of necessity be individual and personal, because you're a limited person. You're not you're not somebody else. You are who you are, with your particular abilities and your particular inclinations, let's say. So there's no such thing as sort of mastery in the abstract, right, of materials devoid of any personality, devoid of any perspective. So if you're mastering the materials, then it means you're mastering yourself in a certain sense. Those two things go together. And if it's authentic and real, and if it comes out of a genuine engagement, then it will, by definition, be original and unique.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. And then I guess if you look back at the greats, all the great artists tended to be what we call them both, a master and a maker. Like Bach, who, we've talked about him a lot before. I mean, there's no denying the mastery or the innovation. It's actually hard to think of anyone who could say is just one or the other.
Yeah, I wonder what that would even look like. Like, how could you have somebody who was innovative but who had no technique? It would imply that everything that they did that innovative was an accident.
But they wouldn't necessarily have to have a masterful technique to be that original.
But no, it's true.
Warhol. How about Andy Warhol then? I put him forward as an example of someone who is very original, but you won't necessarily call a master.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's complicated. I'm going to reveal myself for all of my foolishness on this topic because.
Well, you did it to me a minute ago.
Yeah. Well, what's good for the goose, right? He's really difficult to talk about. I have friends who are massive Andy Warhol fans and think he's, one of the great creative figures of the 20th century. And I suppose if I look at it just on the level of the work itself and I put the phenomenon to the side, when I actually find myself in front of the paintings, a lot of them are very good paintings, actually. I think he had a sense of composition and materials and style, and that was actually quite remarkable. And that's really the level that I would judge anything on, or one of them anyway. They're not bad paintings, They're compelling and interesting to look at. I don't know that his effect was necessarily a positive one overall, and I certainly don't like the sort of the art world turning into this highly market-oriented, commodity-oriented sort of thing, which is what it is now, increasingly. You're an important artist to the extent that you're able to command vast sums of money for the work that you produce.
Yeah.
And one of the most extreme examples of that, I suppose, are the American Abstract Expressionists who, when they were, most of them, until they were middle-aged, lived in total poverty, were totally obscure. Their work met with derision or worse. And it's like you couldn't pay people to take these canvases. And in many cases, within their lifetimes, they became multimillionaires, and now the paintings sell for $100 million or more. It's like, it's a strange phenomenon to contemplate.
Do you think the poetry world will ever end up like that? Have I got a chance?
Well, but it's not a commodity, right? Poetry isn't something you can buy and sell, really. I mean, you can buy a book, but you can't buy the poem itself and hang it on your wall or have it, have exclusive ownership over it, whereas you can actually with a painting.
Have to scroll it on a canvas and sign it. Yeah.
That's right, yeah. It's surprising though, like there are original manuscripts of Beethoven that get sold at auctions, and you can actually get them for shockingly low amounts of money. Like that's for a cultural figure as important as Beethoven, it's pretty amazing. Like way less than what you would pay for a Robert Rauschenberg painting, for example.
Would it be cheaper than first editions by famous authors? I wanted to get into that for a while, and then I saw the amount of money I'd have to raise, and I decided not to.
Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing with music these days.
Well, I'm trying to find a way to make my music match my writing, so I'm working with palindromes and lots of variations on palindromes. So I undertook two big projects over the last three or four years. One is to compose very complex MIDI-based, purely one instrument, in this case a piano, one instrument, MIDI-based palindromic works, where every note is the same, the exact same dynamic, so that it's a very robotic feel. And then the second project, the complementary project to this, is to write palindromic works using very rough recordings of bass guitar and bongos, for which I've had to learn to play the bongos, which has been lovely. It's actually, that's been the most enjoyable thing about it, learning to play the bongos. I don't know why I don't know why everyone in the world doesn't play bongos. It's a great stress relief. And it's so much fun. It's so easy to, you know, practically easy, as in you just pick them up and there you go.
Well, you heard it, folks. Everybody should run out and buy a pair of bongos.
Yeah, definitely.
Instant stress relief. Yeah, so what do you mean have the poetry match the music and vice versa?
Just in the sense that I experiment with palindromes and different types of palindrome in my writing. And so I wanted to do the same with music. I mean, if I could find a good analog for anagrams with music, I'd do that as well. I don't know what that could be, perhaps having the same notes in each bar, but in a different order, something like that. I want to try and write constrained music. And this goes back to what I was saying before, that how I got a bit tired of writing songs because it's the same old formula over and over. And the way out of doing the same old formula is to apply a rule and commit to it and see what variations you can get out of it.
Is that compatible with writing songs, do you think?
It seems like it's easier for me to do this without having to think about writing lyrics and writing something that feels like a song. But my next step after I've completed the current project will be to go back to songwriting in such a way that I'm not writing traditional songs. And as I said earlier, I don't know how to do this. One way, though, perhaps could be to find another rule around which to compose songs. So if the current rule is it goes verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, perhaps with a middle bit somewhere and perhaps with a guitar solo, if that's the formula for your average song, maybe I need to retain enough of that so that it still feels like a song, but have the main rule be something else. I just don't know what that something else is yet.
In any case, you'd be moving towards having the poetry, the words, be integrated into the musical fabric somehow.
Yeah, definitely. Because I like songs. As much as I want to listen to Bach and Schoenberg and all the people that you do these wonderful videos about, I'm a songwriter. I listen to songs more than I listen to any other kind of music. And so I want to return to that. You know, and you know that throughout lockdown, I've been doing nothing but listen to the Beatles. So
yeah,
that set me off on this.
Well, at this point in the podcast, maybe we could hear some examples of the music you've been composing over the past few months.
Yeah, I don't have to play them live, I'm assuming.
One of the things I found really fascinating about the the music you've been making lately is that it's constrained music, which is a concept that I'm not sure how much resonance that would have to most people or even to most composers, because on the one hand, I suppose you could argue that all music is constrained on one level because there are expectations attendant upon all genres and all forms. But a lot of contemporary composition doesn't have any particular constraint associated with it, because you have this illusion, and I believe it's an illusion, of unlimited, untrammeled freedom to do whatever you want. I think that actually leads to sterility and paralysis, personally. But these things you're doing are constrained in the sense that you set rules ahead of time for what it is you're going to do, and you're working with really limited means. It's almost a kind of minimalism, actually, in the sense that you really are just working with bongos and bass guitar. Those are the two instruments that you've been working with for quite a long time now. So if you could say something about the process of putting these things together, what some of the constraints are, and also why it is that you chose to limit yourself to those two instruments.
Well, to answer the second question first, there's a certain practical necessity. I have a very small office space, so I have a small amplifier and I have my computer here, and I couldn't really get a full drum kit in this room. So I had to find another way of getting some percussion. And that was the idea. I wanted percussion and I wanted melody. My main instrument is bass guitar, so that's the melody. And then percussion, I didn't know quite what to do, but I knew I couldn't get a full drum kit. So I asked my friend Samuel Andreev, and he said, buy some bongos. And you weren't wrong. It's the perfect thing. The main constraints would be the restrictions of those two instruments, and associated with that, the lack of any sort of effects, so that this is a raw recording. And then the second one is the palindromic restriction. So it's quite interesting writing palindromic music as opposed to palindromic literature, because they've actually done in very different ways. When you write a piece of palindromic literature, you are working either from the middle outwards or from either end towards the middle, but you're looking at what both sides are doing the whole time. You know, you have to, you can't just write something and then check to see how the other side's doing. You have to work on both simultaneously. Whereas with palindromic music, you can do that. You can just write a piece, like a bar or two of music, and it can be whatever you want it to be. Then you reverse it and you see if it's any good or not. And it often isn't. But if it is, then great, you've got something to work with. Or it might just be the case you need to tweak that a bit. You might just need to slow a bit down or change something in the rhythm, you know, shorten one note. And anything like that, you've got so many different things you can vary. And because it's not semantic, it doesn't really matter if you're just throwing things out there to see if they work or not.
When you're composing a palindrome, you can decide what the theme is going to be, or you can say, I'm going to deal with this particular vocabulary or this particular subject. And I suppose with music, it's the same. You could say, this is the piece is going to have a particular character or a particular rhythmic profile.
Yeah, certainly, especially with the dynamic. I'll say, you know, this is going to be an aggressive piece or... But then these things kind of come out anyway. There are lots of qualities that it doesn't matter what you do. When you reverse it, it's going to have that quality. So if it's going to be heavy, then if the first bit you do is going to be heavy, then the reverse is going to be heavy. If the first part is a slow tempo, then the reverse is going to be a slow tempo. It surprised me, actually, how mood does change. You can write something that sounds happy in its forward incarnation and then reverse it, and it doesn't quite have the same mood, doesn't have the same happiness, or it's got something that seems to suggest a different emotion to it.
Even though it's precisely the same pitches and rhythms.
Mm.
I wonder what your intentions for these pieces are, though, because the poetry, obviously, you're extremely visible on Twitter, and you have a huge following, but you're not really putting out the music to the same extent, or at least not as far as I can determine. So what are you going to do with it? You know, when are you going to let us hear these things?
Yeah, I mean, I've put a couple of small pieces on Twitter, but it's very difficult posting music on Twitter. And it's very difficult posting links to other sites, for example, something like YouTube or SoundCloud. It's very difficult posting links on Twitter. People don't tend to click on them.
I'm curious also about how you manage to juggle all these things, because you've mentioned a few times that, you know, your time is limited because you're very busy running a press. You have, you know, you write prodigiously. It's actually worth pointing out also that despite the ridiculous straitjackets you impose upon yourself when you write, bearing in mind the incredible difficulty of writing the way that you do, it's remarkable how productive you've been. In addition to running a press and creating music and all the other things you do, like, what does a typical day look like? How do you structure your time?
I have a very good ability to concentrate on things, but I'm not very organized. So there are some days where I might wake up and think, I'll just feel it. Like today, I'm writing poetry. Today, I'm going to write 3 palindromic sonnets, and the world is not going to stop me. So I just do that, and that's my day. These days, too many days, I have to actually just do stuff that needs to be done. You know, we've Pentrap Press has published 5 books in the last 2 months, so I haven't been able to have those days where I just write all day. I've been far too busy doing all the boring work that goes with running a press. But this is nearly over, and I get to be free again soon. It's a mixture of days when I have to do my duties running the press, and then days where I just get to be completely free and write whatever I want to. And music hasn't had as much opportunity as everything else, and I feel very bad about that. But I'm looking forward to making more music.
But it sounds like when you're creating something, you sort of have blinders on, right? You can the rest of the world basically ceases to exist, and you just are focusing on the task at hand.
Yeah, I'm naturally a very wound up person, I think. I have 2 modes. I have my day mode and my evening mode. And my day mode is very intense and very focused and completely shuts the world out and just works. And then my evening mode opens a bottle of wine and he's fine. he's fine from there.
And you do a podcast or something.
Yeah, why not? Yeah, so I'm half the day very stressed out and intense, and the other half of the day very chilled out. I'm not working when I'm chilled out. That's the problem. So then I get right. I wake up in the morning and think, I didn't do any work yesterday evening.
I admire you with your 2 modes, because I actually lack the chilled out mode. I don't actually have that. I wish I did. It would probably be good for my health, actually.
I don't know. But I go about it. I'm not sure the way I'm going about it is good for my health.
I find it very hard to switch it off or to switch between those 2 modes. I think the only way I can sustain a chilled out mode would be to go on vacation for 3 weeks or something like that. But it's very hard to do both within the scope of one day.
I suppose I should be grateful. Of course, I'm doing it through chemical means. So
that's cheating.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know if I could do it without a glass of wine. I say a glass.
So it's a question of time, but I hope you do get to spend more time on the music, because what you're doing is quite unique, I think, in many respects, and it's really quite intriguing.
I hope so.
It's got a level of sophistication and thought put into it that, you know, you can achieve in composition, because composed music is written down on paper, so you can take 6 months to write a 3-minute piece if you want. In other words, you can distill a great deal of thought and care into something that's quite short in duration. So what you're doing has some of those attributes, I would say, except that it's not actually, you know, these are not scores that you're writing. These are things that whose final form is a recording.
Yeah. I think the next step really for me with music is perhaps to find a way into music the way I eventually, after 15 years, found a way into poetry. It's very difficult to get any inroads into an industry. I'm hoping you can help me out. But
don't hold your breath.
Well, I've seen you've done videos, haven't you? At least a couple of videos on this subject where people have asked the question of how do you find a way to share your music with people?
Well, I suppose you're striking an interesting balance in the sense that you're creating work without compromise, utterly without compromise, right? Because you can really do whatever you want. You know, you also have a large and an ever increasing audience, and it's increasing in totally unpredictable ways. So who knows where that will end up. And that's something that, God, it's hard to imagine that being possible 50 years ago.
I mean, this does raise the issue of how many bad things are getting through with this increased exposure. Do you think about that often? The idea that there are more opportunities for everybody, but perhaps these increased opportunities are picking out the wrong people? Or is that a horrible thing to think?
I think that in order for the success to be durable and significant, then it has to function in multiple dimensions. You know, having a degree of celebrity on a particular internet platform, let's say, is one thing, but if you can also make that work in physical media, and if you can also get people to go if you're giving a reading or a performance of some kind, and if you can get all of those different dimensions working together, then you've really got something, I think. If it's just a question of, you know, the odd Facebook post or something getting a lot of views, then that's probably not going to do it on its own.
Oh, my James Bond palindrome.
Yeah, but you actually sell books, though. And we should mention you've got a beautiful book out called Stray Arts that I think everybody should read. It's also a beautifully produced book.
Well, thank you. Yes. Stray Arts and Other Inventions, Pentrack Press, 2019. So 2019. I paused over that. That seems so long ago now. 2019.
It does, doesn't it?
Remember 2019.
So what's next for you?
2021 with a follow-up, Slate Petals and Other Wordscapes.
Slate Petals.
Yeah, that's the follow-up.
So is this is going to collect work that you've published since Stray Arts, presumably, or is there a different focus to this book?
It's a genuine follow-up in the sense that it uses a lot of the same constraints, but this is more friendly to the audience. It's whereas Stray Arts was academic, you know, is intellectual and challenging with its use of these certain constraints, that these same constraints are used in different ways in Slate Petals to create something which I hope, I could be wrong, but I hope is more entertaining and accessible. It's the second in a trilogy I have planned, and the third one is going to be very difficult.
Okay, so that's good news, because that means that you can be a complete tosser and still enjoy this book.
Well, the goal with the second book is to say, look, to people who might have read Stray Arts and thought that some of the poems are very complicated, this is a way of saying you can use these constraints and actually they will give you something that will make you smile or will give you that emotional response that you're after. It's saying that, you know, great poetry can be written using these strict rules. Whereas with Stray Arts, it was more about saying, look what I can do. Look what can be done with these constraints. You can make poems this complicated.
Right.
So I want to sort of hold back on that a bit with the next book and say it's possible to write really fun poetry while playing around with rules and forms. Because that's important to me. I don't want to just show off. I want to actually get people to start writing these things. And
well, I've always thought it's important, you know, for artworks to be approachable on multiple levels at the same time, right? So that there should be a level of an immediate approach that's very engaging and direct, something that you can, you know, without necessarily engaging all that deeply with the work, it's still something striking about it at first glance. And then if you dig a little deeper and spend more time with it, you can discover that there are other layers to it and there are more subtleties to be found.
Yeah, so, yeah. I think another way of putting it would be to say that Stray Arts was for people to look at and go, wow, I didn't know this was possible. And then Slate Petals will be for people to look at and say, wow, I want to try this.
Yeah, that's a laudable intention, I think. Absolutely. Makes me think of the whole punk thing again, right? Because to bring it back to that, if you hear a punk song and you're really into it, then there's no reason for you not to think, well, I could possibly do this too. And that's a tremendously liberating thing.
Yeah, well, it's very important. I mean, this is how art survives. So that's been on my mind. But for all the nice things people have said about my poetry for the last few years, I've realized that the nicest ones are when people are sending me their work, saying that, like, because you did this, I've done this. So I guess I'm trying to encourage that, perhaps for my own ego, I don't know, but I'm trying to encourage it.
I think it's the greatest compliment.
Well, you must have received lots of, I mean, especially for your analysis videos. It must be nice reading all the comments, not all the comments, obviously. Because the more you're in the public, I know this, the more you're out there, the more insults you're going to get. But
yeah,
lots of praise too.
It's funny, I do get occasionally some pretty insulting comments, but they just completely wash over me. They don't affect me at all. And sometimes I actually laugh because people can be quite baroque and florid with their insults, which is actually it can be quite funny at times.
Are they affecting you less, the negative ones?
Yeah, probably when I started, maybe the first couple of years, I would get negative comments. And it's not that the comment itself would bother me, because I would think it was true. It would bother me that someone would be, let's say, mean-spirited enough to take the time to say something that they presumably hoped would be injurious. But I don't really see it in those terms anymore. I think actually a lot of people that write negative comments don't imagine that there's somebody at the receiving end, or that someone is actually going to read it and react to it. They imagine they're just sort of interacting with a computer screen, and that's it. And that's fair enough. And the other thing is, if somebody takes the time to write a negative comment, the thing is, they're still actually watching your video, right? It's still, it doesn't really matter in a certain sense.
Yeah, if they didn't like it, they could have just watched it and then walked away from it. But instead, what's happened is they felt the need to tell you they didn't like it, which shows that that's quite an important effect to have on someone, I think.
Right. Well, is there something that they've reacted to, or it's stuck with them somehow enough to react, even if only negatively? But the comments, I mean, comments are very surprising. I often get incredibly long, detailed, thought out comments by people, you know, sharing their perspective on things, or offering a new way to look at something. And I'm just amazed by them. And I don't always respond. In fact, most of the time I don't respond to YouTube comments. It's very, well, considering the volume that I receive, it wouldn't be possible to answer all of them anyway. But it's always surprising. And I think, well, there's actually thousands of people out there watching these and reacting to them. And they're people that I'll never meet. Something very, very strange about that. But it's satisfying in a way.
It's a very funny thing. I mean, like you say about the insulting comments, definitely with me, I'd be far more hurt by them 2 years ago than I am now. Now it just doesn't really bother me at all.
Well, it's just a mode of discourse, and you just accept it for what it is, I think. Hmm. Well, there's two ways to look at it. On the one hand, people will say things on a comment that they would never say to your face, right? Because it doesn't register somehow as an actual human interaction, I think. Plus, it's anonymous, so that's a big part of it as well. The other thing is that the number one reason not to get upset about it is that these are people you don't know. They don't know you. They don't know anything about you. You don't know anything about them. So for all intents and purposes, they're complete random strangers. So if I were to go into some city that I don't live in, maybe where I don't speak the language, and just walk down the street and at random pick out some person and ask them, you know, what do you think about my latest piece? You know, it would be pretty absurd to get upset about the reaction of that person.
Yeah.
But that's essentially what happens on YouTube. You know, these are people, these are random people. I suppose they're there for, you know, because they clicked on a link, or because they were searching for something or whatever, but fundamentally they don't know you. They're not your friends. They're not in your circle. You know, you're not going to meet them physically. So it would be like, yeah, it's like going up to a random person on the street and asking them, well, do you like me? You know, it's like, and then getting upset about that.
No, but it's amazing how quickly that can happen, because like I said, it wasn't too long ago where I would have been quite upset by comments where that now I look at and I just, you know, I just shrug and it's, it's not a problem.
The positive ones too, though, like they don't actually affect me either. So I suppose it's nice in the abstract to get words of praise and all that, but they don't affect what I'm going to do next. and they don't give me an inflated sense of ego or anything like that.
But that can be bad. That can be a bad thing, actually. I've noticed this, that a couple of years ago, again, if somebody sent a comment saying you're a genius, I'd have written a letter back to them. You know, now if I get that, I just like it on Twitter. You think I'm a genius? Great. And that's bad. Right. You know, I should, if someone takes the time to say to you, I think you're a genius, I think I should be, you know, thanking them in the strongest terms.
Right. That person has earned a letter of some kind.
If I had time, I would. So I do worry about that. You don't want to get complacent.
Yeah. Ultimately, it's a question of how much time you want to put into it. You know, as you said, you're a busy guy. And making this stuff takes a lot of time. And I think there's only so much time you can really spend engaging with people's reactions. The things that I'm happiest to answer are questions, actually. Not so much reactions, but questions. If someone has been engaging with something I've done, there's an aspect of it they don't quite understand, or there's something that they want to know a little bit more about, then, you know, if it's an interesting question and they're sincere, then I'm always happy to answer.
Yeah, I've seen, you know, you do make an effort with, when you commit to answering one of the questions that's sent to you, I've seen your replies. You really commit to it.
Well, there's a lot of people out there who, you know, for whom YouTube or Twitter or whatever it might be, like, this is their main source of information. You know, either they don't have the desire or the ability to go to university or whatever it might be. They might not have much of a circle around them of people that are interested in the same things. They might be very isolated. They might live in a very out of the way place, you know, but they're passionate and engaged, and they want to know more about these things. I feel like I have an obligation to engage with those people. There's a lot of them out there.
People who live in Shropshire.
Yeah. Or Strasbourg.